This series of Kicking It Off is sponsored by Bazooka Goals, Airpitch, and 3v3 UK. Having been a coach for over three decades, I know how important it is to have equipment that's easy to use and immediately engages the players. Bazooka Goals is the award-winning pop-up goal that's the perfect partner for small-sided games and training. Remember, every dream starts with a goal. And if you want to take your games to the next level, Airpitch's unique system keeps the ball in play 95% of the time. And coaches, if you're like me and want to bring the best of football, futsal and street football together, then 3v3 UK hosts tournaments and festivals around the country, as well as having a great franchise program. It's all about fast feed fun. All three of these brands will help you create a fun-filled, vibrant environment in which to produce the happy, active, skillful players of the future.
Welcome to Kicking It Off, the podcast for everyone interested in sports, football and the coaching of young children. Today in our online studio, we have another amazing guest for you today. We can't wait to get into this conversation. Today, we're joined by Sally Needham, an all-round legend, not just in women's football, but in the game in general. Sally has had an amazing career so far. You are a UEFA A-licensed coach. You spent time at Sheffield United, Doncaster Bells with the women's team, and you're also now the director and boss lady of your own company, Full Grow. Welcome, Sally. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Lauren. Good introduction. Nice to see you.
Is this the same lady that I know? I had no idea. You'd done all that.
I know. It's a bit of an introduction, that, Lauren. I think I've gone red.
We've got hope for this conversation, Sal. We've been so excited. So this is a question that we ask a lot of the guests that we've had come on in this series. We think it's really important to talk about your journey from what got you interested in coaching in the first place and how that's led you to where you are now and the amazing work that you're doing now. So I wonder if you could, if you wouldn't mind sharing that with us.
Oof, right. It's a long bit of a long story. So I got into coaching actually at college. So I went to do sports at college, and first year got asked if, well, got given the assistant, like, captain role. And my dad used to always say, well, for my voice and organisation rather than my football skills. And I started doing coaching, and I didn't know really that you could get into coaching. And I did my level one, really enjoyed it, went to university to do sport and exercise science, and decided I'd do my level two. And then went and did my A licence, and were working at the Girls' Centre of Excellence at Sheffield United. And then I moved to Donnybells, as you mentioned, and did my A licence, my AYA, but then really got really curious around, right, well, what is confidence? Where does it come from? What's happening when we are delivering all these sessions that the kids just seem to be flourishing in front of us as children and as players? And I really wanted to know the answers. And when I were at Sheffield, I went in at the under-16s level, and we had a group that was high potential but was underachieving, and there were real loads of undercurrents in the group. You could see it in like social elements and the psych elements of it, and because of the AYA and the training in the skills program, we went after it a little bit different. And one of the skills guys, Gary Webb, came in as my assistant, and I used to come home and I used to literally nearly be crying, like thinking, I'm going to have to get rid of some of these girls. Like, they roll their eyes, they're a nightmare in the session. And my best friend at the time had moved in for a couple of weeks while our house were getting sorted out. And she says to me, you're looking at behaviour all wrong. And she'd just been trained up in this Thrive approach. And so I went and did that course, blew my mind, latest in neuroscience, attachment, what happens in brain, through development, what happens in interruptions, how these play out in behaviours, in trauma. Took it back to the FA. Fortunate enough, obviously, I had Pete that was leading the 5-11s, and we started looking at how we embed it into some of the work. I went and did an MA, and Pete was my tutor. And then obviously COVID hit, decided I'd leave. Had an amazing 2.5 years, near enough 3 years at Sheffield United. And then we're doing that at the same time as my professional doctorate. And left in March, and then obviously I'm now in my consultancy role and a few little roles. So yeah, it's been interesting because my prof doc is a professional doctorate, not a normal academic PhD. And my first chapter is my journey. So when I've actually put it down on paper and seeing kind of where I've met people and what have been the major milestones and how it's affected me and how it is today, it actually were a really good chapter to write for my own reflection. So when you ask me that question, I kind of know now my journey, because I've had to write it part of my professional doctorate.
But I think, like a lot of people, I speak to coaches and they say, how do we get to where you are, Pete? Or how do we get a job like yours? And I think there needs to be a realization that sometimes it's a really long journey. But taking that circuitous route really does hook you up with key people, key concepts, lots of learning, lots of mistakes. And I think you don't stumble to where you end up, but there's a real value in having a journey that's longer.
And I think some people do know where they want to be. So, you know, I'm working at Norway Women now, and me and you both know Gemma, and she were very clear on where she wanted to go to. I wasn't. I wouldn't know where my end goal is, but I do know kind of what my purpose is and what I really love in what I deliver. But it has been a real, when you start looking at who you've met and the opportunities and which courses and conversations, they've been probably minimal in that development, but massive in where my journey's gone. And I've really loved delving into now where I am. Like, it definitely is. I love the younger ones, but I love the neuroscience element. And people have said to me all the time, like, do you miss being on the grass? And now and again, I get back on the grass, and I do. But I think I never would have, through school and through university, I scraped it really, even the MA, like, you know, you dragged me through that and got me through it. But now I did it. But within, like, now, like, doing my PhD, I never would have thought I would be doing a PhD. But because I found an area that I'm so interested in, it's really has enabled me to get that way. And I think sometimes you need to do some of the roles that put you in situations that you are giving up your time, that are time-consuming, that are draining, and also in difficult, like, conversations as well, to, like, get to where you are. And I look at some of my, you know, most challenging periods or the bits in my journey, they've actually been my spikes. They've actually been where I've actually really, like, grown. And that's kind of right reason why I left Sheffield when I did. I could have carried at Sheffield. I loved my work at Sheffield, but I was ready for another spike. I'm ready for something else that's going to challenge me. So yeah, when I look back, they're like, yeah, I've took my time with it. There's certain people and definitely experience that I've had that have definitely shaped it for definite. And I think that is the key.
Sally, I'm intrigued. Tell me some of the behaviours at Donny Bell's without mentioning any names. But because I've stood with you when we're watching a session or a game, and you've been talking about, did you see that, Pete? Or he's holding his bib in a particular way, or he's pulling at his shorts. And I'm thinking, Sally, How do you interpret that kind of behaviour that will give you the signals as to how what your next steps might be with that player? So just have a little delve into some of the behaviours and then what it got you thinking about, and then particularly for the coaches that are listening, what are the some of the solutions that you thought might help
That situation? Sheffield, when I was at the RTC, I was literally doing everything instinctively, what I thought from my training. When I went to Donegal's, I was very fortunate, obviously, that I had Chippy as director of football, and she asked me to go to Donegal's, and then she was like, look, this is your playground, like, just explore it. So it allowed me to explore things, and I knew I wasn't going to get sacked, so I wasn't getting paid for it, and that Chippy was my boss at the FA, so she wasn't going to sack me at Donegal's. And so we had a real good, like, go with all different things, and we used to try and do it a little bit differently. So, like, thinking Tuesday, tactical Thursday, fun time Friday. And then when I were watching in our coaching team, we had Emma Coates, who was obviously England now. She was the head coach and very much technical, tactical, and Chippy were there as a director of football. And then I worked as all the social and psych, and then we had Stace, the S&C. And it was just around, right, who we partner up with different people. And then when they were training or were playing, it were like my observations all were about, right, who's starting to tip? So when you are tipping into fight or flight, it's easy to see. Well, it is for me now, and it's easier to see. The harder one were more the freeze, where they go wandering in games or they go drifting. And sometimes I used to watch games, and when I was at Donegal's, I mean, we were in the WSL. I mean, we were 5-0 down one game at Man City, like crazy. And walked in the dressing room and Emma's talking, and it's just a total freeze response. So no learning's taking place, nothing. So I'm trying to have to go around to, like, bring them back into their, what we call their, like, social engagement system for learning, and their, like, green zone. And I'm watching all the time, and then work with Emma around, right, when that player's in that, you need to probably have a bit of a shout and a jolt. When that player's in that, we need a little bit more of a smile. We need a thumbs up, which, when you started delving down into what we get taught on the FA courses around arrival activities, going down to the level, knowing John before you teach him, and hitting the thumbs up and motivation and your face and a smile and all like that. It's everything that we were doing that we got taught in courses. It was just the fact that now I started to understand the reasons why we did it. And then it allowed us then to be more purposeful with it. And sometimes, yeah, I sometimes still watch a game and I look at, like, the formation, or I'm looking at a player or a lens on a player. But a lot of the time now I'm just focusing on behaviours, because when they go into, when they come out of their thinking capacity and into the red zone, whether it's either fight, flight or freeze, there's limited learning, limited decision making, limited scanning, taking place, planning and predicting. So, yeah, Donegal's gave me a real platform to just try things. And then Sheffield United were kind of, right, well, it better work now and I've got to play it properly. But, yeah, it's my lens has totally changed.
And so how was that for the players? Did they then start to recognise in themselves when they were tipping into fight, flight or freeze, and then what they might need to snap them out of it? Because so I'm on the autism spectrum, and it's taken a long time, and still sometimes I miss it when I'm I would call it an overload when I'm going into that state. And I know that anything that people say to me in that moment, it's just going to fall on deaf ears, because there's something that I need to do to either calm myself down, to let that energy pass through my system. And I'm luckily enough that my support network here, you know, dad included, we can operate that really well. But that's taken me a really long time to develop that within myself. And that was something I was trying to do. It wasn't coming from an external source. So I just want to know if you noticed any changes from the players, and were they then taking the initiative? Oh, I think I'm falling into this state. What can I do about it, perhaps? Have you been having those conversations?
No, at Doncaster Bells, I'll admit that. I think I was still trying to learn it, and how I taught it, it was still very much sciencing. I did very much more with the coaches. I think what we applied at Donny was more of a psychosocial model. That I think what you're talking about is very much neuroscience. There's a different level with that. So for me, when I were at Donny, it were very much around the psychosocial element. It's interesting that I've come back across some of the girls in the last couple of years, and even though we got relegated and I think we won one game all season, the girls will still state that that was their best enjoyable season, which is interesting of what we did with them. It was about understanding themselves more, but I didn't have the depth that you've just gone into. Fast forward now from when, like, Sheffield United, massively, yes. So, like, the education of the boys and the data that's come out in, like, my PhD is, they got given the knowledge, they got given the understanding of how the brain, the nervous system operates together, how this then impacts from experiences and what their window of tolerance is to how their brain operates and their nervous system operates. They then got a lot of tools that supported that. And then they got the support as well from me, but also the coaching team, the MDT team. So it was, my work was very much from academy manager all the way through the academy. So the people around them that you're working with every day, like you said, your support network, were upskilled in it as well. So it was a real joined up approach, which, as I've been doing my PhD and my prof doc, the research around academies with some of our psychological provision in the academies is that it's too standalone. It's not a joined up approach. And the boys from previous academies that have joined us that I interviewed, or staff that worked in previous academies, that were their experience as well. So until I got to Sheffield, really, I'd not been able to really delve down into that real science. At Doncaster, it was very much still what I call grass level, psych and social, the environment. And we did little activities about getting them to know themselves, but it wasn't the depth that you've just gone into, and it definitely wasn't the depth that I went into at Sheffield. But we created a really good environment that enabled probably some of that to happen subconsciously and out of our awareness. But at Sheffield, for definite, it was very much more purposeful and very much more targeted work in that area. So, yeah.
You mentioned the environment, Sally. What would, if someone came in, what would they see that might be different from the normal environment in an academy? What would you be encouraging the boys to experience, to do more of, to do less of? What would that look like?
It's interesting. You can get that I'm near the end of my PhD, can't you? Because I've wrote everything up and it's gone in. So I had to proofread it last 2 weeks. So I know this, the data inside out. So it's interesting because part of it, I interviewed somebody from the FA, somebody from the EFL, and somebody from the Premier League that obviously operates in the academy. And it's really interesting that they're only in and out now and again in the work with different lenses on it. But the data that come back were really, really interesting. So, for example, we had a conversation on it off air. We changed our offices. So it were very much, you had a flat desk for power sharing and for interaction and connections. You had then got a quiet area space. We put trees in it because we knew that when you look at greenery, you get your feel-good chemicals, like your brain doesn't know that you're thinking it or doing it or seeing it or it's for real. So we put a lot of greenery on it. We put a lot of round tables in it to encourage more connection and facial cues. And then if you went into the academy, you'd see the fact that the boys would have a mindfulness area. So they've got a mindfulness room that they've got beanbags in, they've got blankets in, they've got a colouring in wall, they've got books, they've got games. We did just order a little guitar for some music stuff with them. And the boys had breath work. So we had individual breath work in the morning that focused on different things. We had individual slots for our injured players. We did yoga 3 times a week. We had cold water baths. The boys did a lot of social activities away from the Academy. Everybody was trained up in the neuroscience. We knew about the power of connection and how we felt. We knew the importance of when they came up for dinner, the dinner staff, of how they connected with them. So, yeah, so it was interesting that the data from the staff that's come out, well, basically from the three from the organisation representatives, just said, like, you could see it as soon as they come through the door. And what really struck me with some of the data was around the language. So we had a very common language around red zone, green zone, and a lot about breath work, and it became a norm. So it was very much around the boys understanding that this is normal, understanding about their body and the brain and emotions and feelings. There's no good and bad. It's in a continuum, and it's about understanding and feeling them and then working with them. And so we had a lot of things in the program that either individually or as a collective that they could go and explore. So there were quite a lot of difference happening within language and what were provided for them. We had like music in for the little ones. We had some like rough and tumble play. We'd really gone out, and we used to play a lot of Bramolet music. So then it was lodged in their nervous system. I did a lot of visualization with them, a lot of meditation. We did some stuff up on the bowling green, and yeah, it was just trying to really develop, like you were saying, Lauren, earlier, like an understanding about how the body and the brain works, being able to sense it, to be able to work with it, so we don't control them, and also develop them as human beings as well as performers, and know that enabling them to understand that it links in unison, well-being and performance links, and for us to be able to develop their, what we call their window of tolerance, their soil, enables them to more flourish on the grass and us pushing more on the grass, but be able to cope with demands of life for deselection, release, injury, relationships, everything that goes in around that. And we changed a few of our like structure for transition periods. So yeah, we did quite a lot. But I was very fortunate that I had a very forward thinking account manager when I first went in, and then got another forward thinking account manager, and I worked with some amazing staff. So yeah.
And so have you got any advice then, Sally, for grassroots coaches or coaches who potentially don't have a forward thinking, you know, manager, or if they're grassroots, they're doing it off their own back, but might not have the resources that you yourself had on your coaching journey? Do you have any advice for them, for these grassroots coaches who might want to take on a lot of the approaches and the mindsets that you've just talked about? How could they get into doing that if they're kind of short on resources themselves?
Yeah, so something that I devised that I had obviously guidance from for Pete was a little bit of like a structure. So we talk around like when you're on the ball, before it, on it and after it. So for me, my top tips around this would be, when children arrive, notice them. So use your smile. Our threat detection system comes from our eyes to our mouth. So when you actually use their name, it hits a certain part of their brain that calms their nervous system as well. So you're basically getting them ready for the session. So smile, use a name, notice something about them. So it's a greeting really when they're coming in. We know personal greetings increases learning, reduces behaviour. And then structure boards. So a normal whiteboard, and you just go like, today I need to be like 6 o'clock arrival activity, 6:15 skills corridor, 6:30 small sided games, 7 o'clock home time. And children that want to know what's coming tonight, or will we play at the weekend, or what we're doing, they're showing that there's anxiety around the session. So being able to give them a structure enables this to then help. And then we always, and we've said it before on at the FA, about rights. So right to learn, to be safe, to have respect. So you have boundaries within that, and we can pull people back on that. And then also arrival activities, which we've done loads about. Research shows there's 10 to 15 minutes. An arrival activity allows the children's brains and nervous system to settle. If they've not had enough play through the day because of wet play, then it allows that activation of the play circuit in the brain and certain areas of our like bodily systems that we need to get ourselves ready for learning. It also gives the coach 10, 15 minutes to set up, or a little bit of time for themselves. Because if they're coming from work or an argument or something. Research shows that a dysregulated adult cannot help to regulate a dysregulated child. So their regulation and their self-awareness is really key. My next thing would be probably framing of sessions. So I would also try and frame sessions. So if you are going to do a session on the fact that referees gave some bad decisions and we had some dysregulation and different behaviours in the game, I would then say to them, instead of just going, right, we're going to do a session where I'm just going to blow and make some bad decisions, frame it for them. Right, tonight, we're going to do a game and I'm going to make some bad decisions, because last week when we played X, I felt some of us got caught up in them bad decisions. I understand it. We're going to work on it together. And then we frame it, which then changes. To change some neural behaviour or a change of behaviour pattern, we've got to bring it into our conscious awareness. So framing is really good for that. And then I would say always check out, but also look at the power of the breath. It is an amazing tool that is a remote control of the body. So enabling a child to come and stand outside of you, or a human being outside of you, and matching breaths. If you're in connection and you're calm, we know what's called neuroception can calm each other's nervous systems. So if a child's starting to tip in a session and I go stand outside of them, or I give them a little tap on the shoulder, we know that touch releases feel-good chemicals, helps calm the nervous system. Me being calm helps calm the nervous system. But using breath work in or before a session for just literally 2 minutes before the start, or doing it as a group at the end of it or before they start their game, is probably my top tip. So personal greetings, structure board and rights, arrival activity, framing of session, checking out, and then look at power of breath.
If you include smaller format games in your sessions, then check out Bazooka Goals, Air Pitch, and 3v3 UK to support the development of you and your players.
It's funny hearing, obviously, I went to drama school, and so as part of our like voice training, so much of it is about breath. And it's just really great to hear that it's, I mean, I resisted it for so long because it took me a while to get that connection within myself and to realize the benefits of it for just me as a person, not as a performer. Mm-hmm. So to know that awareness of, how breath can influence how we feel and therefore how we perform is not in the line of work that I've been doing, acting and performing, and that actually it spread for just performing as best we can as people.
Massively.
Wow, yeah.
So there's different types of breath work that you can do, but we know now that we've got what's called our vagus nerve that sits in our brain stem, and then it runs around our heart, our lungs, bottom of our gut. So when people say trust your gut instinct, it's your subconscious picking up on threat or saying something that you like. But your power of your breath sits in within all of it. So it really is your remote control of the body. So when you're doing things off the pitch, and that's what we did with them, we did a lot of box breathing, or square breathing it's sometimes called. And this through research is shown to increase your vagal tone, which basically means it's increasing your emotional resilience. So it gives you better clarity of thought in higher pressure situations, and you're also able to have more focus and concentration in an actual moment. And you see people do this before penalties or free kicks. They do a long exhale out the mouth, and that's called a physiological sigh, and that is more programmed for in the moment. So it's interesting because the boys, a lot of breath work we've done, we did it with yoga as well, which is about using your breath work. Like a lot of yoga gets delivered in clubs to players around flexibility, mobility. But actually, when you use your power of your breath with yoga, it really moves trauma around our body. And we've all got trauma. Trauma's not have to be this life-changing event. It can be just a small event that we experience it in such a different way than what anybody else would. It gets stored in our body, in our brain. So it's about moving them traumas through his body. So that's why we've used the breath. But it's interesting that a lot of we were playing we're playing a game, and a couple of our lads will always say, like, he needs to go to have some breath work. Like, to about opposition managers, or like, Sally, he needs to come and do some breath work with you. And we always laugh, or sometimes they'll say, like, take your breaths. And it just become a common language that it wasn't done hypercritically or it wasn't done sarcastically. It was very much done like with knowledge, and we had a real big lens shift on that, that it wasn't something that was soft. It wasn't something that you got on board with it. And the ones that got on board with it quicker started to excel, which then started to be that everybody else wants to get back on board with it. And we did a big piece of work on sleep, and that changed language. Like we used to be in like our mindfulness room, and some used to say, "Oh God, really bad night's sleep." And like, and then one of the lads would go, "How many hours did you get?" And he'd go, "About 6.5" "Oh, do you know, Bennett, do you know what impact that is?" So we started to flip like the fact of, you know, that old famous saying of, "You can sleep when you're dead." Actually, no, like sleep's really important to you. I mean, like you're understanding it. So yeah, breath works are really and the different types of breath work, and how we can use the breath work in the cold water, and yeah, we did loads on it. But the boys really did take it on. It's one of the big things that came out.
I think what you've demonstrated, Sally, not just how inspirational you are, but also how you've taken something that is quite academic, very complex and complicated, but what you've done, you've almost been the filter so that anybody can begin to understand it and just do some very simple, really effective things that can have a huge impact on anybody's life. And I think that's the power of what you've achieved. I just think it's fabulous. And I think that's why your impact, it can be so widespread and so influential. You know, if there are any other people out there who, you know, want to get as passionate about this as you, it could be a contagion that really changes everything for us.
No, I appreciate that. It is definitely my lens. And it has been a collective effort at Sheffield, for definite. We've had to have the buy-in. And I think it's took me a while to get to that place where I can explain it in a more of a simplistic manner, but it's a very complex subject. It's never going to be a simple topic because it's a very complex subject, and I'm learning all the time with it. And but when you deliver it, so for example, our 21s manager, when I delivered it to him, he's like, "Sal, like, if I'd have had that when I were playing, like, it'd have been different for me. Like, I used to get dry mouth." I mean, yeah, well, that's a symptom of like being in like fight, flight or freeze. And he's like, "Sally's like, my legs used to feel like treacle. I'd be so fit in training and brilliant. And then I'd come to game and, you know," and he's like, "I wish I'd had that." So when you start delivering it and you start, I think a lot of staff have experienced it, especially in the PDP, because majority of staff in the PDP are normally ones that have played. So, you know, the you start to explain it and they start going, "Oh my God, that is me. Like, that is me." And then they start being able to see it a lot more. So, like, come back to your question around, like, observing it. They're now observing it. And then you're in the reviews and it's like, "Oh, this is what we're working on." And it gets brought up in the reviews. It's not a thing that gets left about. It really is, like, brought into fruition and into the forefront of some of the conversations, which allows it then not to be a taboo subject with it. It's, you know, and because I'm not a psychologist and I never claim to be, and I'm not a neuroscientist, I come from a very coaching background, it's able to be able to apply it then into the coaching. I think that's is the key. That's one of my main recommendations in my PhD. It's the upskilling as well of coaches to understand this a lot more.
Yeah, because I think in the past, and we've had these conversations and we've used exactly these phrases, that in the past we've felt that all the problems lie in the technical corner or in the physical corner. And if you get that right, you're okay. But this is about that connection with the mind and the body and how powerful that can be.
Your bodily state underpins everything you're going to do. So your bodily state is going to depend on your technical execution, your physical output, your decision-making skills, your self-belief and confidence to receive the ball under pressure, to be able to scan, to be able to process the pictures or planning and predicting, to point nonverbal, verbal cues, to give regulation of like a smile, a clap. Everything you're going to do in anything, even Lauren in performing, everything within anybody of human performance is in me delivering a workshop. Everything is built up on our bodily state. And if we understand that this is how it's going to be and we can develop our bodily state as well as really trying to understand how it works and operates it and accepting it, then that's massively the key for me.
And so where can coaches go to either learn more about this, to then apply it either just for themselves as a person, or to then, because I think if you're, like we said, in an ideal world, everybody involved in the coaching of your particular team coaches would be upskilled in this. But if you're the catalyst to start learning this information and start digesting this information, I think it's important that they understand how it's working within them before they then start to ask it of other people. So where can they go, and what any recommendations or places that you can send coaches, things that they can read, podcasts that you've been involved in, where they can just keep learning about this to then start, you know, putting it into practice?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of probably signposting. I work on a theory called the polyvagal theory. So there's a polyvagal institute that you can go and have a little look at, and there's little bits of courses on it, and there's also articles. There's also a book called Inventing Ourselves, which is Sarah Jane Blakemore. So if you work with adolescents, which is 13 to 17, I'd really look at her work. She's amazing in the adolescents. And that book's really digestible neuroscience book. There's a book called Vagus Nerve Reset, which is by Anna Ferguson. Again, a amazing book. And then there's a Polyvagal World book. But I always would advise to start with a vagus nerve reset, because it's around understanding polyvagal theory but being able to apply it. And then the Polyvagal World one's more around understanding, you know, how it's applying in world. Within sport, it's not really being done, touched yet. As I said, there's a course at Polyvagal Institute that's with Michael Allison that's done a little bit about play and sport. But realistically, my work's probably the one that's been the start of transferring it into football. FC Copenhagen have got a research lab with Jez Buster that's a neuroscientist, but they're looking very much cognitive. Mine's affective and behavioural and with some contemplative. I'm hoping, Lauren, that once my PhD is done, that then maybe I look at whether I write a book or I put some courses on for parents, for players, for understanding coaches, you know, and how it's going to evolve. I think that's probably where we'll see where the work goes, who picks it up, where there's an interest in it, and what I do with it. I would like to get some bits out there just to help and support, really, within the football world. But as your dad said, and from my experiences now, it's such a big area that would support in loads of different domains. It's like when I left at Sheffield in March, obviously my role now is consultancy, so where I'm going with things and who I'm talking to, I'm trying to be patient with it and not just jump into projects that I want to do, but hopefully I will get something out there within the practicality of it, because I needed to know whether it worked in practical. And the research is going back that it does, and it's filling some of the gaps that we know that is there already. Where it goes, we'll see. It's an exciting time.
Very, very exciting. Got you on this podcast, and it's just been brilliant. It's so interesting. It really, really is. I think an interesting conversation for coaches, but then an interesting conversation
for anybody
to know. What our bodies are doing and what our bodily state, how that's informing everything that we do. And it just feels like if we as a society have a more general awareness of what is going on and how that impacts not just ourselves, but impacts others that we're interacting with, doesn't matter necessarily then what industry or what line of work we're in. If we've all just got a better self-awareness of what's actually going on internally and how that presents externally, it just feels like it would be great for that message to spread around.
I think you're definitely right. I think one of what it's come out of, the impact of our coaches, and I think we felt this on our youth awards, Pete, the impact of what the coaches have got from the neuroscience stuff, it's come out massively in the data, it's made them better fathers, which then, and the boys have said around, it's made them better in their home life and within their relationships and driving lessons and all stuff like that. So, like, my job title was human development and performance culture, but the human development is, you're right, Lauren, it's key and it can be brought out so much into different areas. And beforehand, like, some of the stuff with meditation and mindfulness and yoga and breath work would have probably been termed fluffy, but the advances now in science through technology now shows us that when we do them types of stuff, this is what's happening in our brain. So neuroscience has only really come into fruition in the last 12, 15 years because of advancing science, because we now have got the science to be able to look at human brains while we're still living. So it's an area that's fascinated me. And every time I go and deliver, I went and delivered at a teaching college of the week, and I didn't know nothing about construction and anything like that. And but we got started delivered, and they're like, all right. And it's just human interaction in, and it's fundamental to teaching and learning, like within anything, within like, and also parenting. Like, a lot of the parents will say, oh my God, like, I wish I'd known this. And if you were to foster and adopt, you get to know it, but you don't get taught it when you have your own. And so I think it's starting to really gather momentum. And really, it's one of my areas. I can remember this, clear as day. Somebody asked your dad once when we're on stage at SGP around what does he want to have as an impact in his life. And I can remember you saying you'd rather have, when, obviously, God forbid anything does happen to you, you'd rather have at your funeral all the people that you've impacted in society and the impact you've had rather than a World Cup medal. And it always stuck with me that, and I'm the same. I like to be in the background. I don't like to be at the front. I know I'm working now with the national women's team, but it's because of the people in it, not because I have declared this to all the players, so they're not aware. The fact of working in an international team and working with the staff that I really value and truly believe in. So it's that's what's the big thing for me, and the little ones. And if we get the little ones right and some of this understanding of it, society, yeah, it's just from all the stuff with COVID as well that's going to come through, and just understanding it's definitely makes you, and I know it sounds really like I don't know, a bit over the top, but it really does give you a more whole being way of being by understanding it.
Without sounding too overinflated, it could change the world. It really could. We are after world domination, and you've heard it first here. We're going for it. One podcast at a time. Sally, that's amazing. Amazing.
Sally, this has been such a fascinating conversation. And I think it's really nice when we get to talk to amazing people such as yourselves who are looking down the lens of coaching and through football, but you've got such a holistic approach to people in general and people. And did you hear the dog, studio dog Dora? Hey Dora, she's late recording, she's missed it. Looking at people, and it's a very holistic approach to being humans, and that is so much of what we've said in a lot of these episodes, that you have to just look at these young children or these adolescents as people first and performers second, and actually knowing what's going on internally is then going to better inform what they produce and how they perform and how they feel within themselves, and that should be the focus really. So thank you so much for all of the amazing tips that you've shared for coaches, pointers and directions that they can get looking in. And I really, really can't wait to have a signed copy of the book whenever you release it.
Sally, thank you so much.
Thank you
so much, Sally. It's been really, really informative and entertaining, but so, so interesting. Thank you.
Anytime. And beautifully summed up, Lauren, as well. But anytime for you, Pete, you know that.
Thank you.
Thanks again to our sponsors, Bazooka Goals, Airpitch and 3v3 UK, for helping us to create the perfect environment to develop happy, active and skillful players.